Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch brings you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's WWE Monday Night Raw.
Well, Tom, Nikki Cross is back. I guess that's our headline from this episode of Raw, attacking Bayley and her cohorts to cause the finish of the main event, or contributing to the finish of the main event. Your thoughts on Nikki Cross, someone you and Corey Graves are very familiar with this version of her, even if Kevin Patrick is not. Hello, Tom. Hold on, everybody. Did we lose someone here? Stand by.
Now, PW Torch brings you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's WWE Monday Night Raw.
Well, Tom, is the headline for this episode of Raw the return of Nikki Cross, someone you and Corey Graves are familiar with, even if Kevin Patrick is not?
I mean, I suppose so. Corey Graves didn't even seem like he was familiar. He wanted to jump in and say who it was, and then he realized that the reveal had not quite been accomplished yet, even though we saw the body type, we saw the signature crossbody off the top, we saw the jacket, we saw the hair, but can't say it yet, and then you've got to awkwardly say, Nikki, 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 before then coming in with the cross. It's not ASH anymore. So, I mean, I suppose so, especially because even in all of that I just described, I don't know if they underlined that the title just changed hands. That kind of feels like even in the wake of the cross attack, you want to at least, you know, put some baritone in your voice and say.
I think it was a non-title match, Tom. I was under the impression, and I think they just tricked me by not explaining it wasn't a title match, but I think it was non-title.
Okay, yeah, see, I questioned that, and I went back and checked your report, so I guess we both got hoodwinked.
Yes,
definitely.
I have since corrected that, and I'm looking at WWE, and they did. They were like, you know, they hyped the match, but they did not hype it being a title match. And then when the finish happened, and it was very underwhelming as far as relative to a title change, then I knew that wasn't the case. The reason I brought up Graves, knowing who she was, is Kevin Patrick had said, this isn't the superhero I knew. Who is this version of her, or something like that? And Graves made the comment that he did know her from the past, indicative of him seeing her in NXT. And he just sort of said with confidence, she's going to be a problem for everyone. So, you know, I don't know if Kevin Patrick did not see that era of Nikki Cross or didn't know it existed, or he's kind of scripted to say that. But Graves is going to be the one who apparently is warning everybody about this version of Nikki Cross. And I'm curious for your take on, well, first, just her getting remade this way, getting this remake, and if you're happy to see her in this role compared to prior roles, especially the ASH version of her, and talk about what you did in NXT, and if this seems similar to that, because certainly Graves alluded to that.
I came to a point in NXT, in my coverage of NXT for The Torch, that I was always describing Nikki Cross as the new Bayley of NXT, or at least the potential new Bayley. She didn't appear consistently enough and have regular enough storylines to really be the new Bayley. But after Bayley moved on to the main roster, Nikki was the one who seemed like she was, she still had that same appeal to the fans that Bayley did as a babyface. And she wasn't always a babyface, but I would even suggest that she was never the type of heel, the type of vicious, just attack everybody, rabid heel that we saw tonight, or at least that we had suggested in that sign off. We still don't know exactly what shape this is going to take. So this seems like it's even still a new phase for Nikki and not just a total reversion to something she's been before. It does feel like a new chapter, at least, you know, in this introduction. I have been throughout her career, at least, you know, in under the WWE umbrella, I've been enough of a believer in Nikki that even when she did go to the ASH thing, I wanted to give her every chance. I was on here with you, I think I was anyway, or at least I was speaking with, you know, peers about just wanting it to work out for her and trying to say like, oh, well, you know, people may complain, but just wait until they see all the masks she sells for Halloween. And, you know, unfortunately that just never panned out for her. So honestly, if I'm happy about anything here, it's just that a talent that I appreciate and believe in is getting another breath of life when she could have easily just been left to languish where she was doing .com exclusives and trying to work angles on social media that never make it to the main television show. But it looks like she's going to get another shot here. So I think that's neat for Nikki Glencross.
Yeah, I mean, she's a respected worker, and she's showing that she is capable of, well, one, just being a really good worker in the ring, who you want to see in big matches. But also just from a promo standpoint, I think that she belongs higher on the card than the almost a superhero gimmick, you know, landed. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I want really talented women who have, you know, paid their dues, for lack of a better phrase, although that term can sometimes be an eye rolling term. She has, and I'd rather see people like her get cast differently, and I don't want to say correctly because that makes it seem like it's, you know, like it's absolute and objective, but cast in a better way with more of an upside, because now we're going to get better promos and better matches and a better presentation of what her talents are. So I'm looking forward to this. It's interesting they have, you know, they're portraying Liv Morgan as having this edge and being hardcore and applauding her approach to things being a lot more vicious. And that Nikki Cross attacking Bayley and company is putting herself out there where the announcers are also going to be praising her for that, which is, you know, I don't even know what to say about it. It's just, it's kind of interesting that, you know, what we see them doing in most eras would be seen as, oh, that's overly aggressive and uncalled for, and what's she doing? But I guess that's part of the cliffhanger.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, the Liv Morgan subject is a different thing. It's felt like she's been gradually turning heel for about 2 months now, but that's not how commentary is painting the picture.
Yeah. So we've got to see. I mean, she's just, you know, going nuts. And I guess I don't really know. And where do you think her character is going to land in 1, 2, or 3 weeks?
Liv?
No, Nikki.
Okay.
Sorry.
You know, with so many people coming in at once, I can't argue with them being featured at first, but maybe having a, I mean, of course, you know, I've said what I've said about Nikki. Of course, I personally feel she's got a proper, you know, of course she is a former women's champion, but, you know, a proper women's championship run in her. But, you know, I also wouldn't be surprised if she just settled in as into maybe a gatekeeper role, mid-card. And that would be a very good spot for her talent level. And I think she brings enough intrigue to what she does as a character and what she does in the ring that would be a good career spot for her. But, you know, at first, give her a program against Belair, who I guess, yeah, News to me, is still the champion.
Yeah, no, I think her returning with this new character suggests to me she's destined, at least at first, to be more than mid-card. I mean, you don't feud with Belair and make that mid-card. I also wonder what it says about where Bayley goes next. Is Nikki sort of a TV feud to stretch out the Bayley thing, or now is Bayley going to shift and damage control going to shift to somebody else? And then that leads to Nikki actually being treated as like kind of the number one heel on Raw going after Belair, once they sort out, you know, what her mission is and why she's being so aggressive and, you know, diving at just attacking everybody.
Yeah, I mean, one would imagine that that LeRae is going to have some unfinished business there. But, you know, even where my mind was at, just I guess assuming that this was a title match, I was thinking, ooh, I think they're telling a nice little story here where Belair is going to be too frustrated and she's going to take her eyes off the ball, and that there's actually going to be a good risk of a title change. I was going into the match thinking it was going to be a title change. That's just where they had my head. And also just looking at the calendar, we're getting toward the time of the year where one would hope that there are plans in place, that there's an outline for what they want WrestleMania to look like and to start building toward, to start really setting the stage for what those storylines are going to be. So I was thinking, hey, yeah, Bayley's absolutely somebody that you'd want in a big program going into a two-night extravaganza. So even though I think last time we spoke, I was saying I think Belair needs to have a longer run, they had me in a place where I thought, you know, the story's right, the timing's right, it happens tonight. So now, indeed, I'm asking the same question, where does Damage Control go from here? And, I mean, not sure how long they're going to keep Candice LeRae off TV, but, man, I don't know. I think the question for me, like, while I'm actively watching the show, the question for me becomes, how much does Triple H want to make up for lost time with some of the NXT darlings of a handful of years ago and give them runs on the main roster that they've been deserving, someone like a Bayley? And how much does he want to use someone like a Bayley, who is a legitimate veteran at this point, and use her to put over other people like the incoming Candice?
What did you think of Candice's sit-down interview performance? The content of what she said, but also the as overt an acknowledgement to being married to Johnny Gargano as we've seen from either of them yet, and just yeah, for the way that she came across in terms of, based on what you've seen in NXT, as somebody who attended so many of those tapings and obviously covered the show for the Torch, is this the best presentation of her, do you think? And is her upside very high, or is she going to be more in the mix with a group of mid-carders feuding with Damage Control?
The way I've always described Candice, and I still feel like it's the perfect way to describe her, even without seeing exactly how she's going to be used on the main roster as yet, is that she was NXT's Natalya, someone who never really had an amazing run, but she was always there to help everybody out, just sort of the mom of the locker room. And that, so because that's my interpretation of basically her entire NXT run, that's where I end up anticipating that she's going to go on the main roster. So as for this, I mean, in terms of what we've seen from Candice over the years, her poison pixie heel turn wasn't super inspiring. So I think that this probably is on the upward end, on the higher end of what we, how they could have approached this. I feel like the content of what she said came off as down to earth and humble and likable, and someone who isn't coming in with a big head, while somebody like Bayley is like, oh man, I idolized her even before I got to NXT when I was watching her on the Independents, which I believe Bayley said on commentary on the show and isn't just something that I read her saying on Instagram or something. So I think that's actually like a part of the television broadcast. You know, she doesn't have that head about herself. She's a human being. We can relate to her. The performance, a bit stilted, but that also is part of what makes her the Natalya.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Very good. Well, let's pause and introduce ourselves and give out the phone numbers and emails so we can bring some other people into the program. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Monday, October 24th, 2022. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the program, the founder of Pro Wrestling Torch, including our Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter, which has been published for 35 years and counting, and also PWTorch.com, well over two decades covering pro wrestling on the internet, and then, of course, currently with lots of podcasts, including the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling podcast and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling post shows like this, covering Raw. We'll also be by Wednesday covering Dynamite and Friday covering SmackDown this week. And the plan is for Rich Fan to be on the flagship tomorrow. So look for that tomorrow night on our Blue Logo show. Just search Wade Keller and subscribe to both. And while you're at it, search PW Torch on your podcast app to get the excellent lineup of talented podcasters on the PW Torch team covering different topics on different days of the week. The PW Torch 90s Pathcast is a fascinating look back at the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter from 30 years ago that week. And Alex McDonald and Patrick Moynihan do a great job just dissecting what I wrote and what others in the Torch wrote 3 decades ago about the big happenings in wrestling. It's a fun discussion. Those two have great chemistry. One is a very big WWE fan. The other very, very much an AEW fan. And both are really interested in that era of professional wrestling, the pre-attitude era. In fact, the show last week talking about some things I wrote about what wrestling needed to do to get a jump start or a reboot. And my editorial, as their take on it, was basically detailing what ECW and Steve Austin and heel Hulk Hogan kind of ended up doing just a couple years later. It's really fun listening to two people read the newsletter from 3 decades ago for the first time and then get together and talk about it for a couple of hours every week. And it reminds me of things I wrote. It reminds me of things that happened 3 decades ago I forgot about. And it's really interesting to hear their takes. So that's just one of many shows on the PW Torch Daily Cast lineup, a different show every day of the week. And you can check out full details at pwtorchdailycast.com or just search PW Torch on your podcast app and subscribe for free. While you're at it, there's one more feed you can subscribe to for free, and that is the PW Torch VIP podcast app. We give free samples of VIP shows on that feed during the month, so it's worth adding that to your list of free podcasts you subscribe to. So 2 Wade Keller shows and 2 PW Torch shows. Subscribe to all 4. And then, of course, while you're at it, visit our main website, pwtorch.com, for our live TV and pay-per-view coverage, breaking news, editorial, special features, and more. That's pwtorch.com. The other voice you've heard on this show so far is Tom Staupp. He is a PW Torch VIP podcast contributor, long time with the PWT Talks NXT gang, now part of the VIP exclusive NXT 8 years back, which includes a lot of NXT talk from 8 years ago, thus the name of the podcast, and also a lot of movie talk, which gives me inspiration for what to watch. And then also every once in a while I shake my head at some things that you really like, Tom, or something like that, but we won't get into that. But mostly I get good recommendations because I'm in sync with you. But you remember a lot more about movies you watched a long time ago than I do, too. So it helps remind me of which ones I should go back and watch. Anyway, that's part of the PW Torch VIP podcast lineup. Also, bonus point, Tom, talk about your contributions, both of the podcasts that you're involved in for PW Torch these days.
Thanks, Wade. Yeah, if you are VIP listening to NXT 8 years back on Saturdays, you know that Kelly and I are knee-deep in the era of the Four Horsewomen. Charlotte is champion. Bayley and Sasha are on the hunt. Becky just turned heel on the latest episode in the feed, mostly because they needed her to, but we know through retrospect that worked out pretty well for her, all things told. And then some movie recommendations for you. And
Alexa Bliss talk too, by the way.
Hey, yeah, true. Alexa still at this point in her pixie cheerleader phase, although I haven't checked myself on this by looking at a calendar or anything, but I don't think we're too far away from her showing up as the manager for Blake and Murphy when she swapped her color scheme from blue to red because, you know, that's the villain's color, apparently. But, yeah, no, movies are such a huge love of mine, and I love that Kelly and I share that passion and get to talk about it on the show as well as we respond to emails on the subject. And I historically, throughout my, involvement in cinema circles, I have been known as someone who has odd taste but I think there are some good recommendations in there. And
totally.
And yeah, monthly you can listen to Bonus Point covering WWE Developmental, and that is I don't cover the NXT television show as much because there are other programs for that, like the excellent Daily Cast show. But this is more the preliminaries and people who are still in training, not even necessarily on television yet. For example, I'm doing my best to glean what we can from the little drips and drops that we learn through social media, through various headlines about the development of Valerie Lareda, who came over from Bellator and is now training at the Performance Center. She does have a wrestling name now. She's not going to go by Valerie Lareda anymore, but we don't yet know what it is. But the next episode of that will be coming out on Sunday, on this Sunday, October 30th. So maybe by then we'll know. You'll have to tune in and find out.
Very good. Did you mention your social media? Do you want to?
At Tom Staupe, I don't use it as much, but you can definitely, like, I'll get notifications. You can definitely get me there. Actually, if you look at Tom Staupe on Twitter right now, I believe it's still the top tweet, has a link to a short film that I made that is appropriate for the Halloween season, and I think wrestling fans would appreciate it as well, because as one of the two principal actors in it, I took some bumps, which I should clarify, we filmed this years ago before I had a really bad back, but maybe some of the filming of this contributed to the issues I now experience.
Oh no. Well, it was interesting Saraya talking about not wanting to take crazy bumps in a recent interview, and it was, I think she doesn't want to be a bump monkey, and I was like, what is that going to endear her with the AW locker room, Tom, if she's using that term for the style that people might expect from her and that she's not going to do anymore? But that's another topic for another show and another day. So we encourage you to call us. We're light on calls today. It wasn't I wouldn't call it a blockbuster episode of Raw by any means, but certainly a lot of things for Tom and I to talk about, and you can join us. Our number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. And when you call, push 1 on your keypad, and that will let us know that you want to be on the show. You can also email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. We are anticipating a call from Justin in just a few minutes here to tell us what it was like in the building. David Bryant, a PW Torch contributor, attended. He is an AEW fan, not a WWE fan. And he attended with a friend of his who was a big WWE fan. He sent some notes along, too, that I might reference as the show goes on about his experience through the lens of someone who doesn't watch a lot of WWE. He did say, Tom, WWE Raw at 3 hours is very long, and it is not nearly the live experience that AEW is in terms of how much downtime there was. And he chronicled all the commercial break video fillers, you know, plugging Rock's movie and little fun things they do on the big screen and that kind of thing. So we'll talk to our correspondent Justin about that too. So anyway, lots of good stuff coming up, some good emails in the queue. But first things first, even though we got more that I want to talk to you about, Tom, we'll go to our first caller of the day next. And our first caller is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, I'm catching you off guard. We're starting with you, shaking things up here. What is on your topic list, the first item?
My first question is on the main event. I don't know if you caught this, but it was Jessica Carr that made the pinfall or the count. And she's a SmackDown referee, even says on her Twitter. Can I pay special attention to her since she started out around here on the local independent scene as a wrestler, so very familiar with who she is. And is that just because she lives around that area of the Carolinas, or do you think she's going to be a regular on Monday Night Raw?
I definitely didn't notice that. It's not something I typically notice, Tom. Did you, and do you make anything of it? I mean, my first guess would be it was either a logistical issue with her being nearby or she's switching brands. But, you know, we'd probably need a few more, at least a couple more weeks to figure out if it's a regular thing.
Yeah, good question. I've followed her since she came to NXT. I did not know her before that, but Google tells me she's from Baltimore. Maybe Ryan's more familiar with the area that she wrestled in rather than where she's billed from. But recognizing her, I certainly took note of the fact that it was her, but I didn't think about the idea that she's a SmackDown referee. I think the most noticeable element of her main roster career thus far is that she seems to have been handpicked by Edge as the person that he likes to have officiate his matches since his return. That's been a pattern. But of course, Edge most recently, I can't remember what has happened in any given draft recently, if he's been a SmackDown wrestler, but we are familiar with him being on Raw most recently. But I would imagine that if there is something to what Ryan is suggesting and that she's known by the local area, that it could have just been a nice little Easter egg for them or even for her, just, you know, a nice, I know she's well liked, and I'm sure Triple H has, I would imagine Triple H has maintained a high opinion of her, and her dedication and whatnot. So maybe it was just a nice little, moment for her.
All right, Ryan, what else have you got?
Second question is on Austin Theory. Is he the front runner to beat Braun Breaker? I know they teased that last week on NXT. And, I don't see anyone else that could beat a Breaker. So could we be seeing like the last Austin Theory on Monday Night Raw?
Tom, what do you think?
I was just on with Greg saying that I think the Ilya Dragunov storyline is going to continue and that Ilya poses a big threat, perhaps Breaker's biggest threat to his title reign. And then Dragunov was the one who ate the pin at Halloween Havoc. Uh-huh. So, the episode of NXT last week was just full of main roster stunts, and it was hard to know what to make of the Austin Theory thing since he had no presence at the PLE. So you're just left wondering, like, were they just trying to get people talking about the event, trying to get more mentions of it on social media by flashing the Money in the Bank briefcase? But yeah, in the back of my mind, I am sitting here thinking, well, Austin Theory certainly doesn't need more time in NXT by any means, but with the question, with the issue, I suppose, that Ryan is posing, that, like, who really is a threat to Braun Breaker at this point, and with the issue of Roman being in the middle of, you know, this great run that Roman's in the middle of, presumably with Cody breathing down his neck once Cody returns, where does that leave Austin? Of course, I've repeatedly predicted that we'll get the Money in the Bank version of the Dusty finish with Cody winning and then Theory cashing in before his contract expires. But might it be interesting to throw him on NXT for a little bit to do? I mean, they've already toyed around with that sort of thing with Dolph Ziggler winning the championship earlier in the year. So, you know, that it's certainly not something sacred that we'd be messing with anymore at this point. So I kind of say, why not? If they're looking at the Money in the Bank contract as something, as a bit of an albatross now that might be holding Theory back because they don't want to end up going with wherever Vince may have envisioned that going, then sure, that seems like a pretty decent way to do that. And another option to think about moving forward, we've always wondered, like, well, could the briefcase be cashed in for the NXT title? And here we seem to have gotten our answer.
I was waiting. I was waiting for the Triple H NXT special of the copyright notice in the lower left of the screen and the sign off, followed by this late cash in run in. And no, it just went blank. And then I'm watching like the Peacock commercial. I'm like, okay, they're going to interrupt this, aren't they? And no, nothing happened. So, yeah. Anyway, Ryan, back to you.
I have a question on Dominic Mysterio. I don't know if you know this. I know this angle goes back like 20 some years with him, you know, being the son of Eddie Guerrero, you know, the custody storyline with Ray. How did that come about? You know, like, is there like any like validity that he could possibly be the son of Eddie, like whether it be that Eddie helped donate, you know, something into a lab, you know, and it helped, you know, reproduce him, or did he like possibly, Eddie, you know, had an affair with Ray's wife or anything weird?
Let's break some news here, Tom. Yeah, let's break some news here to the Mysterio and Guerrero family. No, that was just a tasteless angle. And I found it interesting And effect of in like an effective kind of like, did he just say that heat generating thing for Dominic to compare himself to that and say, I'm the next generation, you know, Eddie Guerrero, I'm this generation's Eddie. But then he took it up another level and going, well, Eddie was a pre-Dominic generation me or something like that. Like he actually reversed it into, instead of him being following in the footsteps of Eddie, Eddie was just sort of a prequel to his greatness. And of course that's, you know, very heat generating because, you know, Dominic is nothing close to, you know, Eddie as a worker. You know, he's not on pace to become anything close to that from what we've seen. There's still plenty of time left. Tom, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the endurance of the custody battle storyline in our consciousness partially has to do because partially has to do with Dominic not having a storied history in wrestling. He's such a newcomer that is one of the touchstones that we have to go back to with him. But also, I would compare it to the Star Wars prequels, and I believe this feud was 2005, same time that Episode 3 came out, where, like, Episode 3 comes out, and we all going to see it in theaters, I shouldn't say all, but the majority of people who went to see it were just like, what the hell was that? Oh, man, George Lucas is ruining his own thing. This is terrible. It's not like what it used to be. Like a lot of we WWE fans felt in 2005. And we didn't like it, but people who were of age to be, and perhaps even in the target audience for a storyline like that, all the relatively tawdry though it may have been, those people are now adults, just like those Star Wars prequel fans were, people who saw it at a less critical age and just loved whatever they were fed. Now they've grown up and they are, you know, thumping their Star Wars encyclopedias like, no, the prequels are actually great, and they're enjoying a bit of a cultural renaissance and getting referenced in current Star Wars media and whatnot. So I think that's my perhaps odd comparison point for that storyline. As for Dominic today, they were really just bathing him with these ridiculous compliments. Finn even called his match with AJ last week one of the greatest wrestling matches of all time. And I liked the approach because one of the things I've been concerned about with Dom is that he's going to be so tied to his father that once he has to stand on his own as a character, and you know, even here he's not standing on his own, he's got three other people with him who are much more practiced in what he's trying to accomplish. But he still doesn't, he can talk about Eddie all he wants. He can mention Ray, but Ray's not there as his foil right now. And sure, storyline's not over. I'm still expecting the WrestleMania match. I'm expecting that either a draft or more likely a Royal Rumble confrontation will reignite that. But for now, it's a test for Dom, as everything has been to this point, really. But this is a big test for Dom, where he's got to do this without being to bounce right off of his dad. And so all of us looking at him critically like we were anyway, and now we're supposed to look at him critically as this newcomer who's not as good as everyone is saying he is, and that's how we're supposed to feel about the character. I liked that they were, you know, just giving him all these massive, ridiculous compliments that wouldn't apply to the vast majority of people that you could say them about, let alone Dom. And still, he's coming off like a twerp. He's sort of got that like prepubescent mustache that he's sporting right now. I think the Domic act is working. TBD, how, you know, what the expiration date on that is, if he does eventually have to break away from Judgment Day and Ray, and then once he's really on his own, maybe it falters. But right now, it's welcome in the opening segment and in a PLE storyline build, because it is something that is over with the crowd.
Yeah, it's generating real heat. Like, JBL's promo gets heat with me, and it's like, some of it is the type of heel heat you want as a heel on a wrestling show, and some of it is, I just want him to go away. I don't want to watch a show with him on it. I don't know what your ratio is with the JBL act tonight and in general, but with Dominic, I don't really have go-away heat, even though I don't want to see him main event. I don't think he's that good. I don't think he's on the track on a trajectory to be that good, but there's plenty of time for him to change that. But for the role that he's in right now, I mean, he's given extra life, extra buoyancy to that faction. I mean, the Judgment Day was – I'm not hearing as much criticism about the group because I think people really like how Rhea Ripley has someone to play off of. She – the Legend of Dominic in 10 years might be what he did for Rhea Ripley's career, more than what he does for his. Maybe. I mean, I'm not saying it's most likely, but I'm not ruling out that the Legend of Dominic is – he was – the conduit to get Rhea Ripley to a whole new level as a character, and the dynamic between them and the way Ripley just seems in a zone and in a comfortable place, you know, strutting around, and the way that she, like, you know, put her hand, caressed his like pectoral muscle a little bit after putting over that he proved he was a man. And it's just like, the crowd's like, just going nuts. It's fun, old school wrestling heat that we don't see very often because people really are mad at Dominic and annoyed by by Rhea Ripley's fawning over him.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that it's the first time I've caught it. I don't know if it's the first time we've heard it overall, but Kevin Patrick was calling her the mastermind behind the Judgment Day. So So she's got that going on commentary.
Yeah, and you know, Balor's doing his best. I'm sure we'll get to that. Ryan, anything else you want to bring up before we move on?
Final questions on JBL. Jim Valley actually brought this up. As JBL became a better promo in the last, like, 15 to 20 years since doing his stint on SmackDown, or is this that the guys and girls nowadays aren't as good as a promo as what they were in that era? My theory is maybe he got better because he's been on Fox News so long and has so much public speaking experience that he's upped his game a bit.
So I thought JBL was a good promo when he got a singles push as a world champion, when they needed to go deep on the bench and try to elevate somebody, and they looked and he was there, and he and Vince McMahon got along, and Vince liked the idea of the character, kind of a J.R. Ewing type character, and JBL ran with it and was more successful than, you know, just about anybody was predicting after the first, you know, couple weeks of that act. I don't think he's any different now than he was when he was world champion in terms of his promo ability, though. Doesn't jump out to me as remarkably different. I think he's being given more mic time now and as champion than he was when he was in APA. But I think it's the same guy who has the gift of gab. I definitely don't buy a theory that by doing new shows, he's become a better promo. I think he's doing the same thing, the same level of quality of promo with Baron Corbin at best than he was as world champion, where I thought he was doing really good work, whatever, 15 years ago. Tom, your thoughts?
I agree with you. I think that the way that he excelled at wrestling promos was why he's translated to the other shows that he's been doing, whether we want to call them news or not. And I say that, I think he does more of an economic type thing. I haven't actually watched a lick of that, so I don't know. But I feel like it's the other way around there. And yeah, I found him effective, just totally despicable and getting, like you suggested, mostly the right kind of heat. And I felt like we heard that from him tonight as well. And maybe he even poured it on too much in the first segment of the match, because after the commercial break, I mean, before the commercial break, he was just tearing Gargano apart. And then the first thing, as soon as they come back from commercial, Kevin Patrick is like, so what do you really think? Or one of them says, you know, what do you really think of Gargano? And that's when JBL said, oh, well, he's terrific. He's fantastic. He's amazing. He's, you know, he's so talented. He's just not Baron Corbin. And I was... That's, you know, funny, yeah. I was waiting for the takedown on the other side, and it didn't really come. So he definitely lightened up, maybe a voice in his ear during the commercial. But yeah, there's a lot about JBL as a human being that we want to boo when he's out there. But I think he earns the character heat as well, and just is a very effective personality. My question just becomes, does Baron Corbin really need? Because JBL's a heat seeker, but so is Corbin. So does he really need the mouthpiece? So that just leaves me wondering, Well, it is. It was in the attempt to the extent that we've seen thus far, repackage Baron Corbin. It is valuable to have somebody on guest commentary talking up how good he is, even when he's going 50-50 with Dolph Ziggler, the person that he basically debuted against when he came up to the main roster. And it was like, oh, it's the obligatory 3-month Dolph Ziggler feud that seemingly all NXT call-ups get. Baron Corbin was more promising than this, but here we are. So that's valuable, but I'm waiting for the moment where Corbin decides that he doesn't need JBL, and we hear JBL's music, but Corbin's like dragging, I don't know, the horns of his limo or something like that. And so it's not Corbin turning face, but it's Corbin becoming even more of a heel because he's beat up a legend of the business, no matter how many local football teams that legend has run down over the past few weeks. So that's what I guess wanting out of this, because I have historically liked Corbin, and similar to Nikki, like, I'm glad that they're trying to revitalize somebody that I think is valuable on the program. But it is odd that they've given a heat seeker a heat seeker.
Your point about JBL going heavy on Gargano being single A, I didn't know he called himself Johnny Wrestling until someone told me today, because I don't follow single A. And I'm just like, if Paul Levesque weren't in charge and he was still running NXT or just off, rehabilitating after healthcare, and Vince McMahon was on headset, it'd be like, how disrespectful to his son-in-law to just disparage this brand, which, by the way, they're running commercials for you to watch tomorrow night. And JBL,
and which, by the way, JBL was the storyline general manager of about 8 years ago.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's right. Yeah. So I wasn't even thinking about that. I mean, I knew that. I wasn't thinking about it. So for him to just like disparage, like, first of all, it'd be nice to have someone push back like you just did. Go, JBL, you spent some time in single A, as you call the wonderful NXT brand that many people love. Like, give, I mean, I don't know. And then also, talking about how Baron Corbin never spent time in single A. I mean, Baron Corbin spent time in what JBL is calling single A. He went through developmental. He was on NXT. He was an early call-up, and people thought it was too early, and he got the height. He got to leapfrog his place in line because of height, but it's not like he didn't spend time there. So, I mean, you know, is JBL going backstage and winking and nodding and laughing and chuckling at how ridiculous he is? I would hope so. You know, in the sense of, let's get those, you know, indie wrestling fan, NXT TakeOver era fans all riled up by me disparaging them. But he does not have facts on his side in the case that he's making.
Yeah, it's helpful that Corey Graves then says things like, well, I was wrestling Gargano 15 years ago, suggesting that they're, you know, angling more at a pre-NXT era. But I at least end up ultimately falling on the side of, well, we aren't intended to agree with the JBL character. He's supposed to be saying things like this that get us riled up.
Yeah.
So ultimately I'm in favor of like 85% of what he's doing.
By the way, I think we're near a point where there's going to be a podcast that plays clips of Disco Inferno on wrestling, making little quips, and Johnny Gargano making little quips and having people guess which person said it. Because Gargano's vocal tones and his self-satisfied bad dad jokes without the self-awareness that they're not good is, I don't think it's good for his character, to be honest. I don't think they're framing him. I don't think he's delivering stuff well. I just don't think the way he's acting around this Miz storyline is as satisfying as I think it's intended to be for people who want to see Miz get his own. I think Gargano's actually been kind of obnoxious, and people can decide for themselves, you know, whether it's a big deal or a positive or a negative to basically be interchangeable with Disco Inferno when it comes to your tone and cadence and jokes. But I planted that seed, and now people cannot not think of it who have heard this when you watch him in the future. Tom, any thoughts on that comparison?
Yeah. This is similar to how Gargano's personality developed in his latter NXT days, but that was after he was already firmly entrenched as an icon of the brand, and he could kind of do no wrong. You know, if there was a dud of a Gargano segment, you still looked forward to the next one because it was Johnny freaking Gargano from NXT. he has yet to prove himself on the main roster. And sure, NXT fans are watching, but like you look at the Candice LeRae interview and she says, oh, well, I've seen that Io is still untrustworthy and Dakota is still spiteful. So sure, there's reference to the fact that they had history in NXT, but it's not like, hey, here's a continuation of this story and this character. You know, it's always difficult to figure out exactly how somebody should be introduced, how much you are going to reference. But when Gargano's acting so smug and just really like nothing about him stinks, I don't think, especially with how careful they've been about presenting him up until I think last week when he started crossing over with this Loomis storyline more than just like a cute little look backstage, like, oh, that guy, which is, you know, just a cute little reference to NXT for those of us who pick up on it. Now it's taking this kind of weird phase at the end of Johnny's NXT run, and you don't need to integrate that into this character that you want to be the conquering underdog, or at least I think that's what they want him to be. You don't have to link him to this weird Dexter Loomis storyline. I'm not for it.
Yeah. All right. Let's bring on Justin, who attended Raw tonight in Charlotte. He is our on-site correspondent. Justin, thanks for joining us today.
How you fellas doing?
Good. So I heard the crowd was good size, like 90% full lower bowl, and the upper deck had, you know, people in the seats opposite the hard cam. It's a big 20,000 seat arena. How did it feel? Did it feel like it filled the arena nicely, or is the arena so big that there were enough empty seats to take away from the atmosphere a little bit?
There was a full side up to the hard camera, all the way to the top. But then on the opposite side, the upper level was tarped off. Behind the stage was tarped off. But I'm very interested to get you guys' take over on TV. But there was a lot of energy in the arena, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that even though WWE was here in March for SmackDown, this was actually the first Raw show in 4 years. They hadn't been here since 2018. So I think a lot of people hadn't been to a Raw show in a while, and so there was a lot of energy in the crowd tonight. I don't know if that translated to TV or not, but live there definitely was a lot of energy.
Yeah, Tom, how would you rank the crowd response compared to what you're used to and remember for a WWE TV show?
It sounded to me like the crowd was responsive. I mean, right from the get-go, you know, Damian Priest is trying to do his all rise. I said all rise. And it's like, well, Damian, visually, we can see that most of the people are on their feet already. So I don't know if your psychology is working there. But, I felt like it maintained throughout most of the night. There are some specifics I'm curious about. But even if it wasn't the hottest crowd ever, I think that was noticeable through the screen.
Yeah, seemed like a good crowd. Justin, was there anything before Raw went on the air that you were on time to see?
Yeah, I actually got there about 10 minutes before main event. So main event had, I think her name is something James. It started with a K. I'm guessing she's from NXT. She faced Dana Brooke.
Kiana?
They had Kiana James. That's who it was. They had about a 4 or 5 minute match. Dana Brooke won, and then she kind of tried to get the crowd to get behind Kiana James, but she ended up turning on Dana Brooke, and the crowd booed her. So really, from that main event show, people were a lot more into that Dana Brooke match than I would have expected. So I guess I should have. That was kind of a precursor of what the night would be like energy wise, because I was kind of shocked. Like, people really into Dana Brooke match. I was kind of surprised by that, but. She got a good reaction, and the match got a good reaction. And then the fake babyface turn also got a good reaction. But then also, too, they had two matches. So it was that match, then it was Von Wagner versus Cedric Alexander, since he's from Charlotte. So they had a match, and it ended in DQ, which I was shocked that a main event match ended in DQ, but what are you going to do?
Wow. How was Von Wagner? Like, what did you think of him in a big arena setting? Did he have a presence to him?
He got a lot of heat because, like I said, Cedric Alexander's from Charlotte, so they were really behind Cedric, and so he got a lot of heat because of that. If you take him away from Cedric, like if he's on Raw next week, he's in the same position. I don't know if he gets that much heat, but he had a good opponent to play off of, so he definitely got some heat tonight.
Cool. Tom, what have you got for Justin as far as questions about Raw itself?
Well, you know what? I actually am going to circle back to a main event question.
Yeah,
did
for sure.
Dana Brooke have her 24/7 championship? Because it seems like they've moved away from that, but she was referenced by Seth Rollins tonight on commentary as being a champion.
Hmm.
Yes, she had 24/7 title with her.
Okay. I'll stick with our Johnny Gargano topic and ask what the reaction was like to him from when he first came out. There was definitely it sounded through the screen like a mixed reaction when he first came out to address The Miz, but then he got another entrance later for his match and worked, however 12, 13 minutes long match that was against Baron Corbin. How would you perceive the crowd's overall reaction to him?
It was okay. I mean, it wasn't bad, because I've seen some Raw shows where he didn't get much of a reaction. So I feel like it was mild. It was okay. He got some cheers, but people was also indifferent as well. Honestly speaking, I felt Corbin got more heat than Gargano got cheers. I don't know if that came across on television, but Corbin got a lot of heat.
That does not shock me, just based on, the context of Corbin and JBL in the WWE realm compared to Gargano, especially on the Raw side of things. Who just jumped out as the biggest star of the night? Was it by a sizable margin Bianca Belair, or did someone else jump out to you? Because it just wasn't a star-studded, loaded Raw from, I think, an in-person perspective with some of the people who weren't on the show.
It definitely wasn't. It definitely was not. I would say it was between Bianca and Seth. I think Seth got a huge reaction. He actually, I don't know if the chance got over on television or it was just my section, but people were chanting they want Seth during the Mustafa Ali Austin Theory match. I don't know if that was loud enough to come across on television, but people was actually cheering for Seth Rollins. And some dude who was sitting across from my section actually got up because he said, I came to see Seth Rollins. I didn't come to see these guys. So he got up and left after the match.
Wow. Wow.
There were several matches tonight. Yeah.
Hold on. Justin, say what you said again, and then I'll throw it to
Tom. Oh, I was just saying, as far as to answer your question, I think it's between Seth and Bianca as far as the biggest reactions of the night.
Gotcha. Yep. Go ahead, Tom. Yep.
Cool. No, I was just going to observe that there were several, at least three, maybe arguably four matches tonight where the impetus behind them, and I understand it's weekly TV and you've got to do this kind of thing, but all on one night where you want to see two specific people wrestle, but then somebody else steps in. Like, ooh, Elias and Chad are beefing, but Otis is going to wrestle the match instead. And that happened multiple times tonight.
Justin, what was the slowest part of the night? And just also, did it seem to drag or move along well? And maybe talk about some of the things that they did in between matches when they were at commercial break on USA Network, and if that worked to help fill in the gaps.
Okay, so I don't think people were really into the Elias and Chad Gable match. I mean, people booed Gable a little bit, but I don't feel like that's the match people were rubbing their hands together to see tonight. The Omos thing, nobody cared about the Omos stuff. Nobody cared about that. A lot of as far as the commercials, a lot of plugging Stone Cold Steve Austin's Broken Skulls podcast. They was advertising, which I think these episodes already happened, but they was advertising the Bully Ray one, Farouk one. So that was something he's really pushing. That and the SmackDown show that's coming up Friday. They really plugged that hard. But that was the two things that they really promoted the most, was Stone Cold Steve Austin, believe it or not. And I personally felt, even though it wasn't a huge star-studded show, I felt like the wrestling was good, from at least from a live perspective, and people were into the matches. Well, the important the matches people felt important. So I feel like people was really into the main event. The Baron Corbin, Johnny Gargano, I don't think Gargano got a huge reaction when he came out, but I definitely felt like this match had a lot more fanfare than the Dolph Ziggler match a week ago. I felt like the opening match had a lot of fanfare as well. So there was definitely some matches that fans were into, but the slow parts is anything with Omos. And like I said, Chad Gable stuff, which I think Chad Gable is a fantastic performer. Watching him live is quite the thing to see. But, you know, you kind of know what you're going to get. You know, he's going to put on a heck of a match for about 10, 12 minutes, and he's going to eat a pig. And so it's hard to really get people invested into a match when they already know the outcome. They know the Alpha Academy is out here to do the job.
What happened when Raw went off the air?
As soon as it went off, they did a U.S. title match. It was Seth Rollins versus Matt Riddle. I actually did not stay for that match because I had already seen Rollins and I had already seen Riddle. So I'm not sure how long that match went or what happened in the match. But that was the dark match, the main event dark
match. I can report there was not a title change. I can verify that much. Tom, any other questions you have for Justin about his experience at the show tonight?
I suppose it's possible that something may have happened in the conclusion or after the conclusion of Seth versus Riddle, and I understand you not wanting to stay any later than you were already there, so that's fine. But when Cody returned, he was working dark mains on shows that he wasn't even booked on just because WWE knew that he was the hot name everybody wanted to see. Now we've got Bray Wyatt back. Was there even something between the scenes during commercial break, any sort of reference to him at all?
No, it was none. The closest relation to Bray Wyatt was they were selling his merch at the merch table. So I actually got him some merch at the merch table. So they had theme masks, they had the Wyatt Six shirts, they had the gloves and all that. So his merch was the biggest presence he had at the arena tonight.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you notice anything, Tom, about anything with Bray interrupting the show or anything like that?
I didn't pick up on any QR codes or anything like that. No.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some people who are disappointed in that. Just people who attended Raw and wanted to see, even if it's just a and a thing on a screen or something, or a flicker of a light.
Yeah.
I was there for that.
Now I do want to.
Yeah, go ahead, Justin.
I do want to mention that people did boo when they put on the screen that Brock Lesnar was going to be on Raw next week. People booed that. they definitely booed that. Now, I do want to get you guys I don't know if you guys talked about it in the beginning of the show because I called in late, but as far as the main event, that was a very flat ending and very deflating ending in that live crowd with the whole Nikki Cross thing, because I was listening to a lot of people in my section, and people was just under the impression that Charlotte Flair was returning tonight, because the match started at like 10:30, and some people thought, okay, they're going to do a run-in, it's going to turn into a tag match, but then a lot of people was expecting Charlotte to come, and when Nikki Cross jumped off the rope and fell on Io Shirai and Dakota Kai, we didn't even know who that was. We thought that was like somebody new or NXT call-up.
Yeah.
And when people found out it was Nikki Cross, it didn't get over with the live crowd. So I don't know how you guys, if you guys talked about it or what you guys thought was, but it was not something that the live crowd, it was kind of a deflating ending to the show because they have done nothing with her, and it just feels like the Mustafa Ali stuff with Seth Rollins, where you got this undercard person mixing it up with top-level people when the fans haven't seen the gradual climb to get to that point. So I don't know what you guys take about that was watching on television, but in a live crowd, people's like, really? So, you know, they didn't like that ending too much.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was kind of curious, and it would be hard to know for sure, but obviously you got a sense of it, Justin, how many people realized who she was, and at that point, if they cared. And having her, you know, attack the heels at ringside and then cost Bianca the match, but then also attack Bayley afterwards, it was a lot of mixed signals about how you're supposed to feel about her. But WWE's been celebrating Liv Morgan having this vicious edge to her, so it's not like in the WWE realm that type of aggression is necessarily framed as heelish. And if you add to it people thinking Charlotte was returning, there really wasn't anything there in a traditional intuitive sense how you would react to that finish. It's a non-title match that didn't really solve anything because the story was about Nikki, not the two wrestlers who got top billing. Tom, any reaction to anything Justin just said there?
Yeah, admittedly, my experience of viewing it was colored by the mistaken impression that the title was on the line, but and that's just, you know, my bad. But
wait, it's
yeah,
my bad, too. You
blame
me. I'm used to them calling it a champion's challenger match. They didn't do that. They just didn't say anything at all. And yeah. Bayley's like, I'm going to...
They actually advertised it like locally as a title match. So it was kind of weird that it was just a non-title match on taping tonight, because it was advertised as, you know, the Raw Women's Championship was on the line between those two. So I don't know if they changed plans and they decided to not make it a title match, but it was definitely advertised here locally as a title match.
Wow. Yeah,
You
feel better.
I feel less bad then. I didn't think about it, but especially there in the Queen City, the ingredients absolutely were in place for a Charlotte return. I don't think the crowd was off base in thinking that was a possibility. Your impression live seems to match up with how they chose to present it through the television screen, because commentary was confused as to who it was as well. Those of us who have been watching...
Manufactured confusion,
Of course, yeah, and I think it absolutely came across that way, and was just a strange moment, because I'm sitting there, even with her hair in her face, looking at Nikki Cross's body type and the jacket that she's been wearing that was given to her by Doudrop. It's like, oh, hey, look, they're doing something with her. So I was happy in the moment, and then they oddly acted like they didn't know who she was until they did, and then they wouldn't say her last name for a little while, only calling her Nikki, until they unveiled, oh, we're calling her Nikki Cross now. So yeah, it was strange on television as well, Justin.
Yeah, I don't know. Look, WWE didn't promote Charlotte, you know, was returning, or she wasn't promoted for the show or anything, but I just feel like sometimes WWE does certain things where they get fans hope for something, and then what they give you is nowhere near what you're expecting. It's like there was no one in that crowd, like, you know, waiting for Nikki Cross to come out. And for that to be the last person you see for the live broadcast, it just was like, you know, it just, you know, I would have rather them just had Damage Control interfere, cost Bianca Belair the match, and they just do a rematch at Crown Jewel, than to have Nikki Cross, who's been off television for God knows how long, and show up and mixing it up with two top stars on the show. I don't think it did any favors for Damage Control. They was kind of an afterthought. I noticed they didn't play the Damage Control theme song. They just played Bayley's song, so I don't even know what that is. As far as are they trying to separate Bayley from them, her coming out with her own entrance and her own theme song. But yeah, just Nikki Cross at the end of the show. That's, if you gave me a million type of finishes this Raw show is going to have, I wouldn't have picked Nikki Cross not one time. So it didn't get over with the crowd. And yeah, I don't really know what they expect, you know, what the plan is. Is this supposed to be, we got to figure out what team she's gonna join for the War Games for Survivor Series? Like, oh, we don't know which side she's on, and she ends up being on the babyface side. I don't know what they're planning, but you know, it was very deflating. I could see a lot of people was disappointed that that match ended with just Nikki Cross interfering and costing Bianca the match.
My final question for you, Justin, I think, is did a lot of people get up and leave after that match, or at least at the beginning of Seth Riddle, because you had seen both of those wrestlers before? Like, because that's when it kind of sinks in. This is the last match on this show. I'm not going to see Brock. I'm not going to see Bobby Lashley. I'm not going to see whoever people might have been in their mind thinking, they're one of my favorites. I haven't seen them yet. Now it's cemented. This is it. I could imagine a decent number of people left, but did they?
It wasn't like the entire arena left, but it was a decent amount of people. They already seen Seth. They already seen Matt Riddle. It's interesting you brought up Bobby Lashley, though, if you mind me speaking about that. He was advertised for the show, so it's interesting that he wasn't on the show at all, except for a video package with them hyping the Brock match. Yeah, he was the one, because originally when he was U.S. champion, he was scheduled to face The Miz. Then they changed it into a triple threat match with Lashley, Riddle, and Rollins. And so for Lashley not to be on the show at all was kind of odd. You know, he was advertised months.
Yeah. Tom, anything else you want to ask Justin before we move on?
Sure. Real quick, how would you characterize the reaction to Dominic Mysterio?
Oh, man, this guy got, being there live, seeing it, I see it on TV every week, but seeing it live, I don't think Finn Balor, I don't feel Damian Priest. I feel like Dominic Mysterio is the one that's really generating heat for this, because when Finn Balor came out and was cutting his promo, people was booing, but they was booing because he's the bad guy and we're supposed to boo. It was when Dominic got on the mic that people generally really start to get into booing this guy. And so, he got a lot of heat. He got, for a long time during that show, no one had matched the reaction he had gotten up until Seth Rollins had came out for the Mustafa Ali and Theory match. So a whole hour went by, and no one had got the reaction Dominic had got on the show. And I still think he got a top three reaction on the entire show. So this dude is a heat magnet.
Yeah.
Sure.
Cool. Justin, anything else you want to share with us that we didn't ask you about?
The last thing I want to talk about, the merch they were selling. I'm always interested when I go to these shows about who they're pushing. And, so Sami Zayn, we talk about Sami Zayn and the work he's doing. You know, he was front, as far as the merch table, he's front and center at the table as far as what they're selling, Bloodline stuff. Bianca, I was shocked they had as much Bliss stuff as they did for her not being on television, not really getting the main event push. I'm kind of surprised that, you know, they was pushing her merch the way they were. But, Sami Zayn, you know, seeing the Honorary Oos shirt, you know, front and center at a merch table with a lot of people buying and a lot of people with his shirt on at the show was quite a sight to see.
Cool. Justin, thank you so much for sharing all those details with us, your experience tonight.
No problem.
Awesome. If you want to be an on-site correspondent like Justin just was, let us know if you're attending a future Raw, Dynamite, or SmackDown. Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. Put the name of the city in the subject line. It just makes it easier for us to stay organized and search for it when the show approaches. And, we can arrange to have you on the show, just like Justin was, to share details on your experience. All right, our phone lines are still open. We have no one left on hold. A couple of people dropped off. So if you're interested in being on the show, it's a short wait. We're going to go to mailbag, though, and hit some of those and cover some other topics in the meantime. You can call 347-215-8558, 347-215-8558. And when you call, push 1 on your keypad. Love to hear your thoughts on our discussion so far or anything that we haven't brought up yet. All right, on to the mailbag. Joe from New York says, and the subject line, Tom, is what's happened to Raw? Hey guys, Monday Night Raw has a serious problem. The show lacks star power. The show is so filled with mid-carders that every segment feels the same. Raw also lacks the cool factor, and it also lacks an adult feel to the product. Plus, young kids don't watch this kind of show in 2022. My point is, who is WWE marketing to? Until they have a real answer to that question, Raw will never be a hot weekly show again. So he's got a second paragraph and topic here, but that is an indictment of WWE. We watched Triple H age in front of us from cool and edgy to the embarrassing dad doing zany, eye-rolling humor, unself-aware, to then sort of being, you know, the leader in charge of NXT who seemed to have his finger on the pulse of what wrestling fans wanted, but not necessarily wrestling fans who weren't already spoken for at this point, perhaps by AEW or the indie scene or New Japan. And so do you agree with Joe's assessment? And this is a tough week because it was, for whatever reason, not a blockbuster show star power wise. But do you agree with the idea that maybe there is, Raw does have a problem, and maybe Paul Levesque has a problem beyond the Fiend and the Bloodline? And I guess you could argue Ronda Rousey, just from a, you know, kind of celebrity star power standpoint. Raw doesn't have any of that. And is it edgy? Is it cool? Is it going back 30 years to what Alex and Patrick are talking about in the PW Torch podcast? Does WWE and Raw need the next big idea in order to bring some younger fans in and motivate some lapsed viewers who are older to start watching now that we're this deep into the Paul Levesque era? Your assessment of Raw?
Well, I often like to compare Monday Night Raw to Saturday Night Live. And Saturday Night Live recently came back for its new season. They are going through another phase where they lost a bunch of their most popular cast members, and there are a bunch of new cast members. People typically refer to these as rebuilding seasons. And Raw goes through those as well. And I think one of the ones I can remember distinctly from recent years is I think it was during that brief phase where Paul Heyman had direct influence over the book. And we were seeing things like Buddy Murphy and Aleister Black getting pushes that weren't super blockbuster, but felt like they could go somewhere if they were allowed to breathe for a few months. And then, you know, the rug ended up getting pulled out from under most of that. But, you know, yes, it is an off week in regards to star power. I think if you got really realistic about it, The Miz was probably the biggest star on the whole show. And, you know, all due respect for The Miz, and I have quite a bit for him, but, you know, that's not when The Miz is the biggest star on your three-hour show with a large cast. Not the greatest compliment.
Especially doing a mid-card comedy storyline with Dexter and Gargano.
Right, and R-Truth. I think you're absolutely right that it's tough to just indict this one episode because you can't have a home run every single week. You know, you can't pull a stunt cast and have John Hamm come in and do a guest spot in your cold open on Saturday Night Live every single week. You know, Brock Lesnar is going to have his weeks off. So that's just how it's going to go. I thought it was an okay show tonight. One of the things that I appreciate about what they're doing right now, and it seems like there's a concerted effort to make this consistent. And even as a viewer, I'm almost adjusting to it a little bit, but maybe this Marvel writer that they've got in with all the experience of rich histories, which ones are we paying mind to, which ones are we ignoring, which ones do we want to directly reference, how do these stories cross over, that writer may be helping in this regard. Where the storylines throughout the night are communicating with one another. Raw actually feels like a real place that exists on Earth. The backstage area is no longer this surreal place where nothing, like no one crosses paths and everything is, if you're in one storyline, that's the only place that you are. You're just floating in space and you're not in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're at Monday Night Raw, which is just at Anytown, USA, or as it was in that first WWE Scooby-Doo movie, WWE City, where WrestleMania happens every single night, I think is how that went. And then of course, you know, Shag and Scoob win the main event and become champions. But, you know, that version of what Vince wanted WWE to be seems to be something that is consciously being steered away from, so Johnny Gargano can deal with The Miz and then go to see his wife, who's involved in a completely different storyline, and they didn't have to cross those over, but they did.
All right, second question from Joe was, Gallows and Anderson are back 3 weeks, and Gallows gets body slammed by a woman. How do you guys feel about that? My thought is, what is the point? Gallows could never touch her to get even, so you just made him look weak when this guy just got back in the company. Plus, Triple H has no better plans for AJ Styles than Vince McMahon did. AJ should still be at the top of the card in WWE, especially when you look at the lack of main eventers WWE has. Styles has been doing nothing for the better part of the last 3 years. Your thoughts? Yeah, I mean, I think AJ likes having Anderson and Gallows to play off of. They're his buds. He had, but it has a Paul Heyman a little bit over that that situation behind the scenes. And now they're back. And I mean, I get that AJ likes playing off of them, but it I don't think it is doing a lot for the perception of AJ as a top star. He seems more like a babysitter, but I mean, I understand like creating a faction to fight a faction and more bodies, and it gives Styles something different to do than work singles matches. And maybe at his age and with the mileage and the tread wear on him, you know, this is welcome and maybe needed. So there could be other factors at play. But I do get what Joe is saying, that, you know, if they wanted to be building the singles division around AJ right now or U.S. title run around him, I mean, they could, and I think fans would be up for it if Styles was capable. Tommy, your thoughts?
So, you know, earlier I said, while I expect Nikki Cross to settle into a gatekeeper role at best, most likely, why not, you know, in this rebrand of her character, just give her a bit of a run in a prominent storyline to identify her and make her seem like there is some level of importance there. And so maybe I hypocritical, I don't know. Selfishly, I do like seeing Gallows and Anderson on my TV. I enjoy them. I like their work. I like their you know, childish humor, at least the way that they present it. I think it's funny to me. It seems very self-aware, but I'm not too worried about the fact that they don't seem like world killers, you know, coming back to the company. They're sliding right back into the spot they were in before as like a bordering on comedy, relatively low card tag team. And I'm fine with that because I think that they serve that role well. And I, you know, I also mentioned this on Wrestling Night in America, but like, these are the kind of guys who can get thrown into a trick or street fight. And instead of whining about, oh, and we're at, it's that time of year too, so maybe we'll see that next week. But, you know, instead of not doing a great job with it, because who wants to work a trick or street fight? This is horrible. They lean into it and make something of it. And I like that about them. These are guys who, like, the last time we saw them tonight, I think, was in that backstage trainer's room segment when they're holding ice packs to their groins, and just the silly way that they pull it off, almost like, I know they're the baby faces here, but almost like the bad guy in a 90s comedy that you're not supposed to take too seriously. I just find it amusing. I think there might have even been some material left on the table when they said, they're sitting there holding ice to their groins, and they say, we have a Rhea problem. And I was half expecting one of them to say, yeah, and it's dire. Yeah, we have a diarrhea problem.
Oh, God.
Because that's their lane. And so that's where my mind is at when they're on screen. And yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe that they had that and they decided against it and you called
maybe,
it out.
Yeah, wisely decided, yeah. Oh, that's terrible. We're not, no, guys.
Yeah, but then this Rhea problem won't make sense. Well, who cares? It's better than actually going to that next step. All right, we got Grant from Detroit calling us. Let's shift back to phone lines here. Grant, thanks for calling. What's in your mind about Raw tonight?
I might just had two things today, Wade. So I don't know if it's me or is something lacking with the presentation of Johnny Gargano. Is it like when he was in NXT, like he felt like the second coming of Bryan Danielson, like as far as underneath babyface, It's like, if you see this, when he came out tonight, it was just no reaction. Like, I don't know if it's because, like, you know, his video wall usually had all the, used to have all the colors, and that's gone. I don't know what it is, but it just feels like something is lacking. And then second thing is,
Yes, I can imagine on paper they thought, hey, what better way to introduce Johnny Gargano and get fans to like him than to have him be the bane of Miz's existence and to help fill in for the fact that Miz is feuding with someone who doesn't talk and makes rare appearances and sometimes isn't even noticed by Miz when he does appear. So I get the logic of it. It's just I just don't think it's working. And it's just been – I didn't think it was working very well early on, and it isn't getting better. It might be getting a little worse. And, yeah, I mean, this is not the second coming of Daniel Bryan, but the comparison is fair, and he could have been under different circumstances. And I can't quite, you know, put my – I can't put my finger on it. I don't know what – I don't in my mind have a vision for what they should have done, but I am watching what they're doing, to me, not work very well in setting up Gargano to be a – big star. That doesn't mean he's not talented enough to overcome this, because he's really good in the ring, and Paul Levesque's not going to be hung up on his size. Tom, throw to you for any continuation on that.
Yeah, I think I'm in favor of how they've carefully presented him in the ring, and at least at first, my interpretation was that they were even being careful as to which crowds they put him in front of in which towns, and only making sure to put him in front of either historically takeover towns or places that are just known for being good wrestling crowds. But now that he's appearing more regularly and showing off that personality in promo segments, that's where I start to get concerned and just sort of console myself like, oh, well, at least he's against The Miz and Baron Corbin, people who, like, anybody will cheer who's wrestling them, right? So that's okay, I guess. But, yeah, the personality, as we covered earlier, is, I think, a misstep at this point. And but still, when the bell rings, I'm in favor of what they're doing with him, and I think that not going to something blockbuster out of the gate is wise, but once we do get to a reignition of the Tommaso Ciampa feud, or if they're able to get, I'm sure there are people on the roster right now, Sami Zayn, you know, somebody who can really work at Gargano's prime level and that they can build a storyline together if something happens where we get an Adam Cole or an Andrade Almas back, where something can be built, and then even if it's not this blowout storyline going into the PLE, they'll have their 20-minute, 30-minute match at the PLE. Triple H is going to look at them and say, hey, guys, this is your moment. Go out and prove yourselves. And they will. I think that's when it's really going to start working. So that's what I'm waiting for, even if what I'm describing is something that we're not accustomed to seeing on the main roster yet.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Very good. Grant, back to you. You can either follow up on our answer or bring up your second topic.
Okay, my second thing was, okay, so this is the second or third story where you got Rhea Ripley getting physical with the men and nobody's able to get their comeuppance. Like, at some point, what are they going to do? Are they going to, like, are we going to finally get Edge spearing her, or are we going to get, like, the OC adding a woman, like, something? But it's like with Mysterio, she was getting physical and nobody did nothing to her. With Edge, she gets physical, nobody did anything to her. Now with the OC, like, at some point, they got to give us something. Like, I don't know.
Sure, we're starting to lose Grant's signal. Tom, your thoughts on what he brought up?
Yeah, I guess I forgot to respond to that detail in Joe's email as well, so I'm glad it got brought back up again. Yeah, I suppose it's been a little awkward with Rhea. I'm not filled in on all of the details as to her health situation, but I believe that she was dealing with something and was only able to have her first full-fledged match in quite a while. on last week's episode of NXT against Cora Jade. No, against Roxanne Perez. So this has worked for her, that she's still able to have a presence on television and be a strong character without really getting too physical, even though, of course, it's clearly not a no-contact policy. But, I mean, she is one of those people who, I mean, you know, there are plenty on the roster, you know, Bianca Belair. There are so many people who, if they slammed gallows, I wouldn't blink. I would just be like, yeah, of course, this is a strong wrestler. That's how these characters are presented. They're not the dainty divas anymore. So ultimately, I'm fine with it. But yes, they do not do the traditionally, unless it's, well, shoot, even in like the Triple H Ronda Rousey WrestleMania match, I don't think Triple H got in any offense against her. So yeah, they don't do that where there's that offense unless it's Triple H accidentally hitting Stephanie. And, you know, that's a slightly, you know, different situation. So there is that awkwardness to it, and I would look at it less as, oh, well, Gallows is being made to look weak, and they had to do, when he tried to address Rhea later, they had to do it off screen because they can't show anything like that. But I think it's more awkward for Rhea's side of it because she doesn't have somebody who can hit her back, so that's when they have to add Beth Phoenix into the Edge storyline and whatnot. So yeah, does the OC add a woman?
Yeah.
I don't think so, because they're so oddly committed to this Bullet Club thing, even though I think maybe 15% of the audience even knows what they're talking about. And for those people who don't, it just looks like dudes who are doing somebody else's hand gesture. I guess not too many people knew about the click. No, they did it. They did it in NWO. So yeah, it's just, I feel the devotion to that on screen is weird. Another thing, kind of like the NXT thing, like, hey, wink to it for those of us who know, but Finn, you don't have to make every single one of your talking points about something that happened in Japan a while ago. And actually, there's something on commentary that Corey Graves said that I got really, I was really irritated by regarding just the significance of all of that on a WWE program. Now that my mind's gone there, I will take the option to segue, since I think I probably made my point and re-irritating myself about the Corey Graves comment. I've forgotten where I was going. But Graves said when Anderson and Balor were wrestling, here it is. He said, it could be argued that they experienced the heights of their careers with each other, referencing their time together in the Bullet Club in Japan. Yeah. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm not the biggest Balor fan, but this is a guy who had an NXT title run, then got called up, and on his first night beat Roman Reigns to qualify for a SummerSlam main event where he became the first ever Universal Champion, and he's been on the main roster ever since. Anderson, much less storied career in WWE, but he was a supporting role in a WrestleMania main event that was technically, yes, it was cinematic, but technically Undertaker's last match. I'm sorry, what they did in Japan and whatever Anderson may go on to do in Japan is not bigger than that. And to be completely honest with you, coming from, like, I'm totally happy with how commentary and even some wrestlers and their promos and whatnot are referencing other, you know, select other companies. It's nice. Again, it's another one of those things that makes it feel like WWE is not taking place in this weird David Lynchian surreal universe. It feels like it's taking place on Earth. But even just opening Monday Night Raw in an unannounced match against one another, that's bigger to the worldwide audience than what a fraction of people saw them do in Japan, no matter how much the people who saw that loved it. So that phrasing from Graves really got under my skin, and I was just like, man, if I was producing this program, I would have a talking to with him.
Yeah, and I mean, it kind of gets to, like, you know, JBL maybe changing his tune midway. I wonder how much Paul Levesque is overseeing this, and if some of this stuff is if he's picking his battles, or he agrees with what's being said, or he just hasn't thought about it. the way that you are talking about it now, but you know, I just don't see any value in Graves saying that unless it is meant to be a plausibly deniable dig at people he's not fond of and is trying to bury on commentary. And I haven't heard that's the case, and I'm not saying that is, other than that's the one logical explanation that I can come up with beyond a random dumb comment that he didn't put thought into.
Let the theories abound about this whole double booking for Anderson between New Japan and WWE.
Yeah. If they did add a woman to Styles, Anderson, and Gallows, to the OC, is there any? Do you have a 1, 2, 3, even 4 candidates that jump out to you that you'd like to see in that role, either currently on the main roster, on the sidelines, who we haven't heard from in a while, you know, a Doudrop type repackaged, or somebody from NXT?
The easy pick is Dana Brooke, just because they've done some work with her before, and I felt that the comedy, the Gallows and Anderson style of comedy worked with her. I would request further time to think of it, because honestly, yeah, Nobody else is really leaping out at me. I would like to answer that, but I'll need a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's where they're going with Nikki Cross.
No.
I don't think they're, you know, it's not going to be Charlotte in that role. Natalya doesn't seem like a fit. I guess the name that comes to mind, probably a better pick than the Piper Niven Doudrop, would be Shayna Baszler.
There you go.
Yeah, with her time off camera, I could see her fitting in aesthetically in terms of appearance and character and style and sort of, you know, in theory, the OC had that New Japan credibility. She sort of got that MMA cred. So maybe Shayna.
Yeah, I think out of everybody on the main roster, that probably is the best fit. With a quick scroll, is there anybody that leaps out to me in NXT? Honestly, with my bonus point focus, the people who appear on Level Up are more present in my mind.
Right.
But you know what? Let's throw Indy Hartwell in there with him. That's another one where I think the humor would match nicely.
Yeah, it depends on if they want to lean into that humor or add a little bit more of an edge. And Baszler gives them more of an edge, because like they're not going to add. I don't, you know, it's not where Liv Morgan's going to land. It's not where Alexa Bliss is going to land. Carmella's not going to go there. I mean, there's just some, you know, I think real obvious people we can just disqualify. But Baszler, a repackaged Doudrop. It does come down with Indy Hartwell if they want to go the humor route. And if so, does that really work with the tone that they're taking with the Judgment Day? Or do they look past the Judgment Day and they just bring someone in to lose to Ripley and then they move on and do comedy or disband? So anyway.
And I guess that is where I was going with the subject, is just saying that I think that this Crown Jewel match is just going to remain the 3-on-3, and that they probably won't look to bring in a woman on the OC's side. It might seem a little less natural than bringing in Beth Phoenix, which for the obviousness of the circumstance was there that they needed somebody for Rhea to play off of, but it made sense with Edge that you would go to that place.
All right, Alan from Cambridge, Ontario says there was too much Johnny Gargano on the show tonight, from his comedy routine with R-Truth, trying to be funny while insulting JBL and Baron Corbin backstage, and then trying to be funny with JBL's hat, and then another skit with The Miz after the match. It just didn't work for me. In my opinion, they're trying too hard to get his personality over. I'm not a diehard NXT viewer, and I know he's a big deal during his run with Champ and Adam Cole, but so far, I'm not on board Johnny Wrestling. Thanks for the great podcast. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we're not alone.
Yeah, and the specifics that he called out, the birthday card bit, saying that Miz should have at least put some money in there because Miz is rich, playing around with JBL's hat, that all fell flat. And I think you could even hear that a crowd that, as we observed, seemed to be reacting to quite a bit that was going on the show tonight, they were not laughing at Johnny dancing in the hat.
Gargano's dance with the hat reminded me of something that Shawn Michaels would do, which made me think he went from one of the more cool characters in the 90s to the most uncool, oblivious, out of touch zany humor eye roll that was possible for a wrestling character, and I just totally buried him, but he deserves it. I want the old HBK back. I don't want the guy who's all bashful and, oh, me, and self-deprecating and all of that. Just be cocky and badass and bring that edge back. But that's my sidebar rant on wanting the old HBK nostalgia to not be from the eye-rolling, bad humor, zany humor with DX, with the late era DX with Triple H. Gargano, but all that said, it does lay the groundwork for that's not something Gargano should be emulating on purpose or by accident, and that's what I thought of when I saw that. But yeah, maybe Ciampa coming back, and I don't know. I mean, Gargano's talented enough. Maybe he can overcome this, but not a good start, and it's kind of a bummer because I think we would have been excited about the idea of Johnny Gargano under Paul Levesque's booking, you know, that this he might be the next Daniel Bryan, and it just doesn't seem like we're on point. And I don't think I'm not against bringing up facts and truth on a wrestling show, but I think it should serve your purpose. I was critical of TNA when they had Sting harping on how old he was. He is ageless.
Oh,
he doesn't look a certain age. Let him just be a current star, and you're not thinking about his age until it becomes obvious and you have to. And it wasn't at that point. With Gargano, I just don't know if Graves should be saying I was wrestling with him 15 years ago in the indie scene. Like, to me, market Gargano as this hot new prospect. Not prospect, but this hot new star who's finally arrived on Raw, and everywhere he's gone, he's been a main eventer. But don't hit us hard with how when you were in elementary school, you know, like he was wrestling. Like, I just don't think you want to be telling 20-somethings that.
Yeah, I'm totally with you.
Even if they know, just don't remind us. Like, just his story.
Right.
it doesn't mean lie to us. It doesn't mean that if we know it, we can't enjoy him. It's just his story on the main roster should be different than that. So tell us a different story by emphasizing different things. You don't have to shine a lantern on his age and mileage. Okay. JB from Detroit said, where do we think this new Nikki Cross character goes? Is she similar to the Nikki Cross of Sanity in NXT, or is she something else entirely? Based on what we saw today, I imagine she'll have a much tougher edge in one way or another. And is there any chance she gets paired up with Bray at some point and becomes part of the rumored Wyatt Six? Has Bray Wyatt said the Wyatt Six, or is that social media and the internet? Because he brought up a circle, the Wyatt Circle, or the Circle of Bray or something. I'm not sure if they're attached to the Six necessarily, but nevertheless, that's in a way neither here nor there. He finishes, Sanity and the Wyatt family shared a similar vibe. Love the show, and everyone go VIP. Thank you, JB. Tom, I mean, this didn't come across to me as somebody headed for the Fiend character. It felt like an introduction of her character. I think the reintroduction of her would have been with Bray if it was going to be that, or it would have had more of a otherworldly vibe, and it did not have that. So I don't think that's where they're going. But obviously she's going to have more of an edge and be more aggressive. And whether she's more like Nikki Cross and Sanity or not, I don't think we got enough of a sample to decisively say that. What say you?
Totally agree with all of those points. And I still am not certain where the Wyatt Six reporting or rumors are sourced from. I have heard them from some sources that I trust, but I still am not sure where it originally came from. But because it has been such a talking point surrounding Wyatt, while I'm not trying to think about it too much when I'm actually listening to what Bray says in character on the show, in something like this, I can't lie and say that it didn't cross my mind exactly what you just said. Well, I guess I'll cross Nikki off the list on the candidate list. Because she was somebody who came to mind actually when Bray first introduced the Firefly Funhouse. I forget exactly where Nikki was at that point. Maybe she wasn't even on the main roster yet. But I remember predicting that she could be like his sidekick, you know, the children's show vibe of that. She could be like the baby bop to his Barney, which probably ages me as far as like what I was watching when I was young. But I think that it would fit with her, but this reintroduction here precludes her because of exactly what you just said. If they were going to reintroduce her as part of that, they would have just done that and not done this here. And so I think that something changing in Alexa Bliss is still a very appealing option for multiple reasons there. And perhaps the most likely, if not the most exciting, is that Liv Morgan will go that way as well, just because she's part of the family.
All right, up next, Zach in Texas said the opening of Raw had to be an all-time bad opening. Rhea, Finn, and Priest taking turns putting over that walking billboard for nepotism was painful to listen to. Rhea has been the glue holding this thing together. The Judgment Day has thrived almost exclusively off her charisma, and they're having her wasted on someone whose ceiling is not much higher than her boot. Seriously, Dom is objectively terrible at basically everything and has not shown any consistent improvement in 2 years. If his daddy weren't Rey Mysterio, he'd have been cut a long time ago. Eric Watts, the barometer for terrible second-generation wrestlers who got pushed solely because of nepotism, only lasted 6 months. Dom is not much better, and he's been around 2 years. Watts' push ended when the regime changed in WCW. Why didn't Hunter avail himself of the opportunity to cut his losses and send Dom on his way back when he took over instead of putting him in an angle intended to last months? At least have the Ray Dom match at Blood Money 9 so we don't have to pretend Dom has talent for the next 6 months. So some big differences here, Zach. One, Eric Watts was pushed as a sex symbol, the second coming of Jack Briscoe, and a top contender, an imminent world champion by Bill Watts. And it just, you know, it was just embarrassing. And it really turned people against Bill Watts, who were very excited about the Bill Watts era of WCW at that time. So much context and history there. A lot of that covered in the PW Torch 90s past cast, by the way, for people who want to learn about that history. And of course, our PW Torch back issues will take you through the Bill Watts Torch Talk interviews, the one that got him his job, the one that got him fired from his job, which ironically were the same interview, being brought forward at two different, very different times in his tenure. Dominic has not been pushed like Eric Watts was. He is the in over his head son of Rey Mysterio at the beginning. His storyline has been centered solely until recently around Rey and him being young and trying to figure things out. Will he or won't he respond well to his dad's motivational speeches? Is he going to turn bad or is Rey turning on him? A lot of starts and stops to the storyline, but that's been the sole thing. And he hasn't been featured in a lot of singles matches where he was exposed as beneath his push. But that said, while he is getting TV time, he's also getting a ton of heel heat right now. And he's competent enough in the ring to not be an embarrassment. I'd like to see him be getting better quicker. And I have not heard pro or con his work ethic. But he's not unnatural in the sense that a lot of people are. But I think he's being pushed as he's with the Judgment Day, because the Judgment Day want to hurt Rey Mysterio, not because they genuinely think Dominic is a great wrestler. And he's also with them because he's doing whatever with Rhea Ripley. There's certainly the implications are considerable. So I just don't think the comparison holds up. I think your example, Zach, is too strongly worded to hold up to scrutiny. And I think a softer argument against his push would be more well received by me and more, I think, consistent with, you know, what a criticism of Dominic's TV time needs to be. And I think Derek Watson is stretching it. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, I know Zach feels that I've been too easy on Dom, but I think we're seeing the evidence that it is effective. I think it is, they are achieving the kind of heat that they are going for. And you and I have covered what we felt worked about the segment, what we felt, or at least what I felt were some detractors, like the focus on the Bullet Club, even before the Corey Graves comment. But thinking about Rhea perhaps having, you know, an anchor around her ankle, I would disagree, just because of her whatever her health situation is. She was still able to appear on TV in a role that seems like it is a stepping stone for her, not something that is actively defining her down, when maybe just being off TV entirely waiting for a big return would have been better. I think this is something that's identifying her with the crowd, and it's absolutely something that will ultimately be a footnote in her career. I think, you know, if things go for Rhea the way that a lot of us have foreseen for her, there may come a day where we're just like, oh yeah, and remember when she did that thing with Dominic? Oh yeah, but it's certainly not the first thing that we think of when we think of her.
I'll also say Dominic's charisma as the guy who's smugly walking around, shoving it in everybody's face that he and Ripley have something pretty good going on off screen. His demeanor has been spot on, and it's one of the reasons he's getting a ton of heat. Rey is a very popular figure, and pro wrestling does not have a great track record when it comes to sons of famous wrestlers and promoters thriving. They swing and miss more often than they even hit a single, much less a home run. But right now, Dominic has helped the Judgment Day, and he is a valuable character. I think the coverage of Dominic is in the context of his limitations at this point. But I think you can't ignore the pluses. I think Solo Sikoa is getting way more praise than Dominic as a new addition to an existing faction for good reason. And I think the context, at least from my perspective of over here at the Torch, I don't think we are, and I don't think I see others touting Dominic above what his actual contributions are. And I think Zach's just being too hard on him. All right.
I agree all around. And on that subject, Von Wagner came up earlier and it got me wondering, Wade, are you kind of quietly rooting for him since his father was in the AWA?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, Wayne Bloom and I go way back. So, I was touting Wayne Bloom to be a rising star in the dying days of the AWA. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a soft spot there. But, I mean, I'm going to judge him objectively. But, you know.
Sure. Oh, of course.
But well, yeah, and I know you're not suggesting otherwise. But am I thinking, oh, it'd be kind of cool if he, if he turned out to be good? Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, I don't know that Wayne Bloom got the career that I thought Wayne Bloom didn't have the career that I thought he was, one of the Beverly Brothers. Not the Mike Enos guy. And then Destruction Crew is good and talented. It was a weak, late stage AEW didn't have a lot of rising stars, but I like Bloom's demeanor and his sinewy toughness to his ring style. And there was an edge to him on camera. There's an edge to him off camera. And so, if Von Wagner has some of that and grows into a decent worker, he's got a distinct look. So, anyway,
oh, yeah.
I mean,
he definitely does.
Yeah, he's not at the top of my list of draft picks of people who have yet to be on the main roster or work a pay-per-view match. But, but yeah. Anyway, let's. Is there anything else you want to bring up from the show, Tom, before we sign off here?
Just some quick bullet points, which, could have easily been left on the cutting room floor, but given the opportunity, I thought it was neat that there was somebody brought a Creed Brothers sign. I'm guessing it's because Julius wrestled for Duke, but that was there. Johnny Gargano mentioned that Ciampa is injured. I think we expected as much, but I'm not sure that was confirmed. Maybe I missed that along with the Wyatt Six reporting, but that was brought up. Something I didn't mention about the LeRae interview, I thought it was nice that they did a multi-camera scene in the back, but they actually justified why there would be multiple cameras there because they were setting it up for the sit-down interview. And for as much as I am beyond over the whole Elias thing, and not even just the recent Zeke stuff, just in general, I haven't enjoyed the guy since he was El Vagabundo in NXT, for one taping, but that was the one thing I was like, oh, hey, that thing he did was fun. I am sort of intrigued by the idea that he's being brought back as a babyface, perhaps just because they were predicting, maybe I'm looking too deeply into it, but perhaps they were predicting that, oh, just bringing back the character will get a favorable response. So let's not fight against that. Let's let the crowd cheer him at first. But he's clearly annoyed by Riddle, and I don't think they're turning Riddle. So I am sort of intrigued to see exactly what Elias is going to do with this Riddle relationship, as he's just wanting to hit him with his guitar, but then going yeah, you were cool with Zeke though, so I guess I'll let you slide. And then just of course the tongue-in-cheek humor of Kevin Patrick, just with no ounce of humor in his voice at all, saying it's Elias's first match on Raw in over a year. And that's just sort of amusing to me. But
I
Chad Gable saying Blink-182 shoosh, I thought was hilarious.
Yes. I want to know. I want to know for sure that Ezekiel and Elias aren't different people, and I'm less convinced after this week, because now that Elias is back wrestling, he's a star and a half below Ezekiel. Like, Elias didn't have good matches. Ezekiel had pretty good matches. He seemed like a pretty – is it just the jeans? Is he working the same match, but it's just the jeans versus the wrestling tights or trunks, and that's what's throwing me off? Or does he work a different style? Because, I mean, he went to a side headlock like 40 seconds into the match, and the announcers are like, yes, he's catching his breath. And it's like, what? I know it's his first match back in a while, but my God. And then it didn't get a lot better. And, I mean, there were some moves that showed some light, and I don't know. They even replayed in slow motion Elias completely missing the knee when Gable was flipping over him. And I was like, well, they're not going to use the same angle, obviously. And they used the same angle. And so, I don't know. But back to my point, I think Elias and Ezekiel are different people, because there's no way Elias would dumb down his work rate compared to what Ezekiel showed he could do.
I'm going to guess that Dean Ambrose sat Elias down and at one point and said, like, hey, man, 10% cotton jeans. They stretch a little bit. That's the way to go. And it's just, you know, growing a nice beard like that, it saps a lot of your natural energy out. So that's, I think that's what it is.
The aerodynamics too.
Yeah.
You know, it slows you down. Yeah. Yeah. All right. We'll end on that note. Tom, thank you so much.
Thanks, Wade.
Yes. Thanks everybody for listening, and our callers and our outside correspondent. We'll talk to you all next time.